The humidity in Port of Spain during the spring of 1937 did not just sit on the skin, it pushed against it like a physical weight, a thick, salty blanket that smelled of burning cane and stale gin. In the shadows of a makeshift bamboo tent on Edward Street, a young man known then only by his birth name stands near the edge of the torchlight, his fingers nervously tracing the brim of a borrowed felt hat. This is not the era of international tours or the soft glow of BBC microphones. This is the era of the Old Brigade, where a man's reputation lives and died by his ability to weaponize the English language against the very crown that imposed it. The air is thick with the sharp, metallic tang of sweat from the crowd packed into the benches. They have not come for a melody. They have not come for a celebration. They have come for a bloodletting. The first sentence of the history we are told is a lie. We are taught that Calypso was a gift of celebration, a rhythmic export meant to brighten the drawing rooms of London and New York. The truth is far more jagged and far more dangerous. In the decades before the world knew the name Lord Kitchener, the music was a coded survival manual for the displaced and the defiant. It was the sound of the yard, the rhythm of the barrack house, and it was considered a criminal offense by the men in white linen suits who sat in the governor's office. To sing was to gamble with your freedom. To win was to become a king of a kingdom that the authorities refused to acknowledge existed. Within the archives of the Trinidad Constabulary, there exists a ledger from 1939 that few historians have dared to open. It contains a list of confiscated lyrics, hand-scrawled on the back of cigarette packets and rum labels, marked with a single red stamp, subversive. Among these entries is a reference to a song that was never recorded, a track titled The Ghost of Prince's Building. For decades, the Johnny Walker element of this history has been this lost composition. It was rumored to contain the names of three men who disappeared from the docks of Port of Spain after a labor strike, names that the Calypso King was said to have hidden within a complex series of double entendres. This song was his insurance policy and his death warrant. We need to talk about the forensic reality of a 1930s Calypso tent. This was not a theater. It was a structural defiance of colonial architecture. The posts were carved from green heartwood, still weeping sap. The curtains were often old burlap sacks, stitched together with twine. When the rain hit the galvanized iron roof, the sound was like 1,000 drums beating at once, forcing the singer to project from the diaphragm until their throat felt like it was lined with glass. The lighting came from kerosene lamps that flickered with every gust of wind, casting long, distorted shadows of the singers against the bamboo walls. If you look at the floor, you don't see carpet. You see packed earth, darkened by decades of spilled rum and the rhythmic stomping of thousands of feet. You are standing in that crowd right now. Can you feel the heat radiating off the person next to you? Can you hear the low guttural hum of the bassman as he tunes a four-string guitar with rusted wires? This is the moment before the fame, before the velvet suits and the London tabloids. This is the struggle for the soul of a nation that doesn't yet have a flag. Ask yourself, if your words could land you in a colonial prison cell tomorrow morning, would you still have the courage to step into that circle of light? By 1940, the pressure in the colony is reaching a breaking point. The transition from the rural stick-fighting Kalinda to the urban Calypso has created a new kind of warrior, the Chantwell. These men are no longer fighting with wood and bone, they are fighting with meter and rhyme. The core conflict is not just about music, it was about the ownership of the narrative. The colonial administration viewed the Calypso tents as breeding grounds for sedition, and they were not wrong. Every night, under the cover of the rhythmic boom and chime, the history of the Caribbean was being rewritten in real time. The investigation into the king's pre-fame life reveals a calculated dance with the censorship board. The board was comprised of British officials who lacked any understanding of the local patois. This was the king's greatest weapon. He would submit lyrics for approval that appeared on the surface to be innocent tales of domestic disputes or observations on the weather. But in the tent, under the flickering kerosene light, those same lyrics were transformed. A broken fence was not a piece of wood. It was the crumbling infrastructure of the colonial government. A stray dog was not an animal. It was an undercover informant for the police. The king was a master of the double meaning, a linguistic ghost who moved through the halls of power without ever being caught. The evidence of this resistance is etched into the very recording equipment used at the time. When the scouts from American Labels arrived, they used primitive wax cylinders and early acetate discs. These machines were sensitive to the heat and the salt air of the Caribbean. Often the most radical performances were lost because the wax melted or the needle skipped during a particularly loud burst of applause from the crowd. We are left with the sanitized versions, the tracks that were safe enough to survive the journey back to New York. But the locals remember. They remember the nights when the king sang until the sun came up, documenting the strikes, the riots, and the secret meetings that the history books choose to ignore. Let's look at the micro scene of 1945. The war in Europe is ending, but the war for identity in the Caribbean is just beginning. The king is sitting in a small room in Laventille, the smell of salt fish and fried bake wafting through the open window. He is looking at a steamship ticket. In his pocket is a small, hand-bound notebook. Inside that notebook are the names of the three men from the 1939 strike. He has spent 6 years turning those names into a melody. He knows that if he leaves, the secret goes with him. If he stays, he will likely be silenced. He picks up his guitar. The wood is worn smooth where his thumb rests. He plays a single chord, a minor sixth that hangs in the air, vibrating against the wooden walls. This is the sound of a man who is about to become a ghost to his own people, so he can tell their story to the world. The escalation of his career began the moment he stepped onto the deck of the Empire Windrush. The world sees this as a moment of triumph, the arrival of a new cultural force in the heart of the empire. But look closer at the footage. Look at the king's eyes as he stands on the deck. He is not just looking at the white cliffs of Dover. He is looking back at the islands he left behind. He is carrying the mystery thread with him, tucked into the lining of his coat. He is the guardian of the ghost of Prince's Building, and he knows that London will never understand the song. The London years were a facade. While he was being celebrated as a novelty, he was using his platform to fund the independence movements back home. Every pound he earned from his catchy hits was funneled back through secret channels to the organizers in Port of Spain and Kingston. He was a double agent of culture. The technical details of his arrangements during this period show a deliberate complexity that baffled British musicians. He was using African polyrhythms underlaid with European harmonies, a musical middle finger to the idea of cultural purity. He was proving, note by note, that the primitive music of the islands was more sophisticated than anything the mother country could produce. Now we return to the ledger from 1939. After the king's death, a researcher found a single acetate disc in a basement in North London. It was cracked, the surface covered in a fine layer of dust and mold. When it was cleaned and played, the voice that emerged was thin and haunting. It was the king, recorded in secret in 1947, just weeks before he emigrated. He was singing the song they told him he couldn't sing. He was naming the names. The mystery thread was finally unspooled. The three men who disappeared were not just laborers. They were the king's own cousins. He had spent his entire career building a legacy of fame just to ensure that when he finally spoke their names, the whole world would have to listen. The legacy of the Calypso King is not found in the trophies or the honorary degrees or the statues in the park. It is found in the silence that follows the music. It is found in the unexplained gaps in the recording catalogs and the coded messages that still resonate in the bass lines of modern Caribbean sound. We are the inheritors of a history that was sung before it was written and fought for before it was celebrated. He was the man who turned a bamboo tent into a throne room and a guitar into a shield. This brings us to a final uncomfortable truth that splits the fans of this history down the middle. One side argues that the king was a hero who successfully infiltrated the West to save his culture. The other side argues that by seeking fame in London and New York, he inherently sold out the very street resistance that made him powerful, ultimately sanitizing Calypso for a global audience. Some say he won the war. Others say he just moved the battlefield to a place where his people couldn't follow. Was the Calypso King a visionary revolutionary who used fame as a weapon? Or was he a man who traded the raw, dangerous truth of the tents for a comfortable life in the empire he claimed to despise?